From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're on Radio Row, Meghna, in Philly at the DNC. And oh, who's that? I think it's Katy Perry.
Uh-huh.
Oh, what else were we going to do here? Oh, right. We were going to talk about what else happens tonight. Meghna, some union members with I Built the DNC t-shirts are already packing some things up, but the podium stays. Hillary Clinton will speak tonight. Katy Perry will sing. It's just a little bit more Katy Perry. Okay, there we go. We asked people this morning what they want to hear from Hillary Clinton tonight and what they thought of last night's marquee event, President Obama's speech.
I think it was great. I think that as far as Hillary Clinton tonight, I think all she has to do is tie the bow around the whole thing. You know what I mean? I think she doesn't really have to do much.
I was impressed. I think he touched all the marks he was supposed to. Brought out Hillary's strengths. I'm hoping to hear what she's passionate about, what she plans on doing for the American people and for the world.
President Obama was fantastic, and the surprise of having Secretary Clinton come out at the end was, I get the chills right now, seeing that embrace, literal and figurative, and a vision to the fact that we can continue on the positive, inclusive, diverse path we've been on as a nation.
Voters Carmen Guzman, Kathy Duff, Xavier Bell in Philly this morning. And last night, President Obama recognized Hillary Clinton's long career in public service.
Sometimes during those 40 years, she's made mistakes, just like I have, just like we all do. That's what happens when we try. That's what happens when you're the kind of citizen Teddy Roosevelt once described. Not the timid souls who criticize from the sidelines, but someone who is actually in the arena, who strives valiantly, who errs, but who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement.
Let's get Here and Now political analyst Jamal Simmons in. He's a Democratic strategist. You know, Jamal, that obviously, as you said last Friday at the end of the RNC, the President Obama was throwing some shade a little bit there. You know, that was directed towards newcomer Donald Trump. But
yeah.
Can that backfire on the Democrats, pointing out that there have been mistakes?
Well, listen, everyone knows there have been mistakes. So the worst thing to do is to act like something is not wrong when, in fact, something did go wrong. So I think it's impressive for the president to bring that up, talk about it, get it on the table, and then let's move on, because then voters will sort of trust you to keep moving. But if you try to tell them that blue is green and they know that green is blue,
right.
that it's not.
Well, you say when something did go wrong, I mean, the Republicans can say there's a list, you know, of things. But you know, what do you think overall of last night and his, President Obama's, list of her achievements?
Oh, I mean, it's fantastic. I thought that President Obama did what he needed to do in terms of bringing people together, getting them focused on who Hillary Clinton was. We've seen that really all week of people talking about who she was in various ways, from President Bill Clinton talking about her as a person and their personal life together, to some of the people who are testifying to how she helped them and the programs that were created and how they've helped them in their lives. And so now here we have President Obama, who can tell you what it's like being a president of the United States and saying, here's somebody who's ready, and more so, Donald Trump is not ready, and he's a threat. And not only did President Obama do a good job, but also Joe Biden, and I was incredibly moved by Gabby Giffords.
Well, a wonderful speech, but President Obama called Donald Trump the Donald. A homegrown demagogue, Vice President nominee Tim Kaine mocked Trump's believe me phrase, not very good imitation, but and here is Vice President Joe Biden's argument against Trump.
His imitation wasn't that good either.
Yeah, no. Here's Joe Biden.
No major party nominee in the history of this nation has ever known less or has been less prepared to deal with our national security. We cannot elect a man who exploits our fears of ISIS and other terrorists, who has no plan whatsoever to make us safer.
Donald Trump tweeting out, President Obama is talking about a world that doesn't exist. 70% of the people think our country is going in the wrong direction. Did the Democrats offset some of that last night?
Oh, I think the Democrats have been offsetting that all week. And I think from Joe Biden's remarks, where he also did a very good job in talking about what's important and what's so great about this country. And I think from both the Biden and Obama remarks, he did such an optimistic vision of where America is versus where Donald Trump sort of lays out, which is this dystopian vision where America is falling apart and it just needs some strong man to come in and save it.
But can they risk being too optimistic? If there are people who are really hurting and they feel as if they're being told by the Democrats, there's nothing to see here, you know, those are the people that the party needs.
You know, the presidential voice, the bully pulpit, is a force multiplier, to use a phrase. It does make people, if the president's talking down the economy is probably going to stay a little lethargic. If the president's talking up the country, people are going to feel better about it. So
and
it's
therefore
important
go out
to
and
keep doing
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
yes.
It's like you create what you are talking about. What does Hillary Clinton have to talk about tonight?
She's got to talk about the future. We've now been fully briefed on the past. We know who she is. We know where she comes from. We know the people who've been important to her. She even got nominated by a childhood friend who shouted out her parents, Hugh and Dorothy Rodham, who've now passed on. It's now Hillary Clinton's turn to talk about what she wants to do with the country, how she's going to make the country better, how she's going to heal some of the problems that still exist, and capitalize on Barack Obama's administration to make the place a better country.
Look, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were at loggerheads, you know, when they ran against each other, and they healed that. But
absolutely,
this is different. This is someone who's not. Does she go after Trump?
I bet she goes after him just a little bit, some glancing blows. But the real focus for her is going to be giving people a reason to vote for her, not just a reason to vote against Trump. I think we all know why he shouldn't be in office.
Well, that's, again, here and now, Democratic political analyst Jamal Simmons. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, when the final gavel brings the Democratic National Convention to a close tonight, the general election is going to be well underway. North Carolina, long Republican but more recently a swing state, is expected to be a regular stop for presidential hopefuls through November. Jeff Tabiri from Here and Now contributor WUNC reports on how a group of voters in the Tar Heel state could help decide the outcome.
4 years ago, just Florida was decided by fewer votes. In 2008, only Missouri had a presidential contest that was closer than North Carolina's.
I think it's quite possible that we end up being the closest state this year.
Tom Jensen is the director of Public Policy Polling, a national firm based in Raleigh. For three decades, North Carolina has been a Republican stronghold in the presidential race. Not anymore. The polling firm's most recent data shows Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton tied in North Carolina. Other polls call this a toss-up state.
I think what's 100% going to end up deciding the race in North Carolina is what ends up happening in the suburbs of Wake County and Mecklenburg County.
Meet the swing voters, many of whom are transplants from blue states like California, New York, and Connecticut. They're largely independents and mothers. Pollsters say they altered the election here in 2008 and 2012. Carter Wren is a longtime GOP strategist. He calls them an interesting group.
They don't really like either party. They don't really like politicians. They're fiscally conservative on values. They're religious. But on the other hand, government programs like education, Social Security, Medicare, they're very supportive of. So it's sort of a group of people that don't fit into any political boxes.
Wren first worked on a campaign in 1972, helping Jesse Helms get elected to the U.S. Senate. He's not working for Donald Trump. Asked what he would advise the Republican nominee to do in order to win that slice of suburban voters, Wren said play lots of attack ads. And another tactic.
Some positive introduced about Trump that gives the undecided voter some comfort with him. They're never going to embrace Trump, but they need to be a little more comfortable with him than they are right now.
Gary Pierce is another longtime political operative. He worked for North Carolina's Democratic Governor Jim Hunt during his four terms in office. Pierce is not working for Clinton, but offered his approach on how he would help her cause.
The easiest way to win an election is to just destroy your opponent. And there has never been an opponent who invited it as much as Trump does and makes himself vulnerable to it in the way he does. So that's what I'd be telling her.
Clinton's campaign debuted TV ads in North Carolina earlier this month. One features some of Trump's most bombastic comments as children watch him on TV.
I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay?
And you can tell them to go themselves.
You know, you could see there was blood coming out of her eyes.
Pierce calls the 30-second spot incredibly effective.
That goes right at that suburban, independent woman. it goes right to this fear that there's something about Donald Trump. There's a cruelty or a bullying or a meanness to him that I really don't want to see in the White House.
There are more than 100 days between now and the second Tuesday in November. And pollster Tom Jensen says if you're a political junkie, it's an exciting time to be a North Carolinian. But
if you're somebody who's really a political junkie, it's an exciting time to be a North Carolinian because we've never been this important. If you're somebody who gets sick of the ads, gets sick of having to see the candidates on TV here all the time, all I can really say is buckle up. It's going to be a long 3.5 months.
Trump and Clinton each campaigned in North Carolina this week, and they will be back soon, likely close to where some of those swing voters call home. For Here and Now, I'm Jeff Tiberi in Durham, North Carolina.
It's Here and Now at the DNC. Farmers are watching this election closely. Reportedly, some in California are switching crops, worried that if a wall is built, they won't have pickers. While farmers in the Midwest are concerned that cutbacks in government subsidies of ethanol will mean less of their corn sold. We want to take a look at another concern of farmers, safety. Have you ever had Seven Stars Organic Yogurt? It's terrific. It's made in small batches on a 420-acre dairy farm about 45 minutes west of Philly in Kimberton, Pennsylvania. It's distributed across the country. And the other day, I took a drive out to visit with farmers Edie and David Griffiths. This is beautiful Pennsylvania farm country, gentle rolling fields.
Hi.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Give me a hug. Edie Griffiths greets me in her driveway. She's a neighbor of my sister Gail, which is why I know this incredible story.
This way.
I'm here.
David?
Inside, Edie calls for David, and he comes around the corner in a motorized wheelchair. David Harris has no movement in his legs, some in his arms, hardly any in his hands. He's been largely paralyzed since a farm accident 16 years ago. So, David, why don't we just start with what happened?
It was a beautiful August day, and I had cut a beautiful, beautiful second cut of alfalfa and grass. And I had mowed it and baled it into round bales, and the round bales were sort of a brand new innovation on the farm. For many, many years, we had hauled these small square bales around, and it was an enormous chore every day. In the winter, when we fed it out, a chore again. And so these round bales were able to be moved with a front-end loader. So I was loading bright green bales of hay into a hay barn, and as I was lifting it up with the front-end loader, the loader attachment kept tilting back further, unbeknownst to me, and when I looked up, the bale was rolling down the arms of the front-end loader and essentially rolled over me, crushed me. It was like I'd been hit by an electric voltage, and everything, my nervous system just stopped working, and found myself face down between my legs. And I knew instantly there what had happened.
You knew what?
I knew I had broken my neck. I mean, I knew I was paralyzed. All I could do was just kind of duck my head and my body as this 600-pound bale went over me.
Even now, as you sit in your chair, when you're telling the story, I can see you. You're almost like trying to move away from that bale again.
Yeah, no, it's a vivid memory. It's not something you forget.
Did you know at that point how dangerous farming is? You know, wearing seatbelts and tractors, who knew? And having sort of crossbars above you in machinery so that when there's a rollover, I'm wondering, even in, you know, the situation you had, you're somewhat more protected.
Yes, I mean, rollover bars, or post protection. We had vintage 1960s John Deere tractors that didn't have those features. And I think everybody who had been involved with farming could tell you horror stories, because it's the kind of news that spreads quickly in a small community. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you knew about it, and you knew the dangers, the various dangers in operating equipment. The round bale rollback type injury that I had was fairly common in the 90s because a lot of people were using tractors that did not have four-post protection on them that would essentially block something. I have to believe there's still somebody out there who's still using the same kind of equipment I got injured in.
Well, then let's get that message out, huh?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's there's so many different ways to be injured on a farm. That cow with horns there, if somebody were not to know to, you know, give her a little room, you know, in a second, somebody's eye could be poked out by a horn. You know, it's just that quickly. Power takeoffs on tractors, PTOs are horrible things. There's a shaft at the end of the tractor that connects to trailing equipment like balers or mowers. It's a spinning drive shaft, and they should have safety guards, and people get caught on them and wrapped up in them. Grain is another issue. People drown in grain because they get someone turns an auger on and they get sucked right down into the grain. Silos, silo gas, they have around here just about every year or so, they'll have some description of some person succumbing to silo gas and silo and then having other members of his family just climb in after him and have the same thing happen to them.
Well, but what about the other part, that you're here and you stayed here on this ground near this? I don't know if I'd ever want to see a hay bale again.
Well, I definitely have. I got real issues about, I mean, there are things that when I see things happening on the farm, it really triggers some bad, you know. So I guess I've got some trauma issues about, specifically about farm injuries. Like when I see a football game where they have to stop because the guy's not moving on the field or something, I can't watch that.
That trauma is perhaps one reason David doesn't come with Edie and me as we walk next door to the Seven Stars farm. The other reason is the heat. It's 100 degrees, difficult for him to breathe. Fans blow in the wide-open hay barn. Swallows fly around bales stacked 50 feet high. It's hard not to think of that day 16 years ago.
This is the barn in here where his accident happened. It hits you sometimes. It hits you.
He survived.
He survived, and I'm grateful always because he's there for us. He's there for our children. Our daughter calls him every day.
Did they want you to leave this place?
Not my children. David did. Yeah, he thought it was too much for me, too hard. Which, yeah.
It was.
It was, but it was what I wanted to do.
Well, that must have been terrible for him. I mean, it's being, you know, suddenly finding yourself paralyzed, anybody. But this was the hard, hands-on work he did, and you must have felt so emasculated that he.
I can only imagine, you know, what it's like when you are concerned about what's going on down at the farm and you can't just run down and go see.
Or, as you were saying, you can't help your life partner. You're watching her sweat and do the work.
Yeah, you can't.
We go on to the cow barn, filled again with huge fans and pretty somnolent hot dairy cows chewing cud. This is a biodynamic farm, a practice inspired by Rudolf Steiner of Waldorf School fame. The Kimberton Waldorf School is right across the street. Very simply put, it's a belief in an almost sacred interconnectedness of soil, grass, and animals who, for instance, get homeopathic remedies instead of antibiotics. Which is why, when the Griffiths recently realized they could no longer farm, they sold much of the operation to Mark Dumphy, who, with other friends and family, had been helping the Griffiths keep things running. Today, two of Mark's sons, Zach and Ryan, are here working. Do you guys think a lot about what happened here? What happened to David?
Absolutely. I mean, that tractor's still on the farm, and every day we look at it, it's a reminder of these things happen. And you get a hot day like today, and everybody's just, you know, pushing a little bit, and you're trying to get done, and the unthinkable happens, and, you know, it's a constant reminder.
And Zach, how old are you?
24.
You were about 8 when this happened to David. But is it part of your thinking, too, you know, when you do your work?
Yes, definitely. And every time I put bales away, it's in the back of my head, definitely.
This isn't just a business. It's a value system.
I'm wondering if that's it's something you're especially conscious of because you have this man who can't do it, you know? I mean, you're carrying it on not just for someone who's turning it over, but for someone who can't.
Yes, definitely. I mean, both Edie and David have taught us a lot. It's an honor to carry that on.
You discover a whole new world once you become disabled. You get used to whatever the next reality in your life is. Moaning about it ain't going to improve the situation. Paralysis, the hardest thing for me was that my hands didn't work. And I kept looking at it, and that was the hardest thing to accept because I was always a jack-of-all-trades, master of none. And the one thing that really worked well were my hands and my ability to just kind of figure things out.
And milk cows.
And so the fact that they didn't work is very hard. There's a side of most farmers who believe that they are invincible, that they can do things that they maybe wouldn't even ask other people to do. But, you know, it just takes a second.
David Griffiths in Kimmerton, Pennsylvania. We also spoke with his wife, Edie. By the way, David was alone when that hay bale accident happened. He lived because a neighbor's dog heard his feeble cries. He was helicoptered out. Another danger for farmers there in rural areas. In this note, David said he's been inspired by Dan Gottlieb, a host on WHYY, who is a quadriplegic. David said he always thought that meant he was on a gurney near death. He said he now knows he's nearer to life. For pictures and more on the Seven Stars Farm, go to hereandnow.org.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Blue Apron knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals, so they follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week by Blue Apron's culinary team, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. There's no weekly commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/here.
Do you get endless phone calls from debt collection agencies even after you've paid the bill? Well, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau wants to change that. The Bureau announced new regulations today that would prevent collection agencies from contacting someone more than 6 times a week. They would also have to make sure the debt they're going after is actually owed. Business journalist Ali Velshi joins us from New York with more. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Meghna. You know, this has come up. This Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has come up at both conventions because the Republicans hate it. And at the Democratic convention, Elizabeth Warren is the one who started it. And like mortgages, many consumer and credit debts are sold and resold. And the buyer of that loan hires third-party collection agencies. And as you mentioned in your introduction, sometimes they go after entirely the wrong people. In fact, it's kind of remarkable what percentage of people get chased down for debts they don't actually have. So this is an effort to clean up a patchwork of state regulations under some federal regulation. First of all, make people prove that whoever they're trying to collect a debt from actually has that debt. Allow those people to appeal it if they don't believe they do. And then if the debt is legitimate, impose a few controls as to how that debt is collected.
Right. And so this is something that could potentially affect a lot of people. I mean, the Bureau estimates that 1 in 3 consumers, 70 million people. 70 million people have been contacted.
Yeah, I mean, the New York Times did a great story on this, and they had a story about an administrative worker in California got a call that she owes $10,000, and they started garnishing her wages. And she just couldn't get them off of her case. They were able to finally figure out a way they threatened a lawsuit, and as a result, the debt collection agency, they don't like lawsuits. They don't make money off of those. They backed off. One of the problems when you are in a debt collection situation is you have often signed off on arbitration, which means you can't sue and you can't join a class action lawsuit. So that's one of the things that they're saying. If you let people sue, the threat of lawsuits will get the debt collectors to get a little more organized about who they're trying to collect from.
Right. There are a lot of efforts to take on those arbitration clauses here. But
yeah,
of course, debt collection is a business. They are hired by creditors. Yep. What has the industry said about these new regulations?
Well, strangely, it's always one of those things where the industry spokespeople say they welcome the discussion because they'd like to actually get clarity about how things work. As I said, this is mostly done by states, and they are, as an industry, they're sort of saying, well, if we have federal regulation, then it makes it easy for a Texas debt collector to go after somebody in California. But generally, they say they've already taken steps to clean up their act. The trade associations say they adopted new certification rules for debt collectors this year, and that they're going in that direction anyway. Part of the issue is the debt collectors can be very, very aggressive. And some of these rules are to say things like you can't contact the potential debtor more than six times in 1 week, because sometimes they just call you. They call you at work, they call you at home, they email you, and people find that it becomes a very stressful enterprise.
So what can people do right now? I mean, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau says it gets more complaints about this than anything else. And
Well, what they should do is they should ask a consumer who gets any kinds of threatening or collection phone calls should ask for a written notice detailing the debt, log all of your contacts with the debt collector who called, and then call the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau if you feel like this is not correct.
Business journalist Ali Velshi. Ali, it's always great to talk with you. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
America's struggle with the legacy of slavery surfaces again and again. It did this week after Michelle Obama spoke about how slaves built the White House. Fox News host Bill O'Reilly said those slaves were, quote, well-fed and had decent lodging. Well, a new novel asks us to think about the moral implications of slavery a bit differently. It asks, what would America be like if slavery had never really ended? That's the unsettling world that novelist Bill Winters creates in Underground Airlines. Victor is the book's narrator. He's the troubled heart and soul of this alternate history. He's a bounty hunter who searches for escaped slaves. And Victor is also black. Author Ben Winter joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So let's just start at the beginning. Where were you? What was going on in the world in your life when you decided that you wanted to write a book like this?
Professionally, I was wrapping up the third in a trilogy of these sort of speculative fiction mystery novels that I had done. So as an artist, as an author, I was really looking forward to doing something else, using kind of mystery tropes and alternate history tropes. And then as a human, as an American, I was, and like so many of us, just continually shocked and horrified and distressed by incidences of police violence in African-American communities. And I guess I just began thinking and then researching and then writing about the origins of racism and racist violence in this country, which all emerges from slavery. So I that's where the book came from. It became an idea of taking this figurative idea, in a way, slavery is still with us, and making it literal.
Right. You know, and the other thing about your book is it just reminds us how, again, it's speculative fiction, but in truth, like history, the path that a nation takes, even individuals take, can really turn on a dime with just a couple little tweaks here to a timeline. I mean, for example, in your book, President Lincoln is assassinated in 1861. In the earliest days, is it before?
He's on the way. He's on the way to be inaugurated. In my
book,
he's
right.
He left Springfield, as he did in real life. He left Springfield on a train to go to Washington. He made stops along the way. In real life, he got there. In my novel, he is assassinated.
Right.
And now, in the present day, slavery remains in four southern states. And crucially to the novel, the Fugitive Slave Law, now called the Fugitive Persons Law, is still in force, meaning that, as it was in antebellum times, if a slave escapes, it is the responsibility of local law enforcement to return him or her to their quote-unquote owner.
So that brings us to Victor, the main character in the book. He is a bounty hunter of slaves, but he's also black. Tell us about Victor.
We find out fairly early on he is himself an escaped slave or a person born to labor, or PB, who was caught and instead of being returned, sort of forced to work for the United States Marshal Service as an undercover enforcer of the Fugitive Persons Law.
Well, there is a terrific passage in the book, Underground Airlines, where Victor describes a little bit about the reality of his life. And I'm wondering if you could just, if you could read that for us.
Sure. I am an undercover operative in a dangerous line of work, but understand that I am also an African-American male living in the United States of America. There are going to be checkpoints. I am going to get stopped. Every once in a while, I'm going to have to dump out my bag under the watchful eye of some kind of lawman. sheriff's deputy, patrol officer, state trooper, what have you. When that sort of BS happened, I had no choice but to submit. I had no badge, no ID. I was true undercover right down the line. If you saw the way I traveled, if you went through my suitcase or the trunk of my car, you'd think I was a thief, some kind of con man. Which I was, of course. Really, that's exactly what I was. I was a thief. I was some kind of con man.
Con man? I mean, who is Victor conning? I mean, himself? Everyone else around him?
Well, day to day, that's what he does for a living, right? Yeah. He cons people. He goes undercover and pretends to be someone that he is not to achieve an objective. But he is. He's conning himself because he tells us very early on that there is nothing he can do about his fate. He is resigned to his existence.
Mm. So there's a middle part of that passage where Victor says, there are going to be checkpoints. I am going to get stopped. Every once in a while, I'm going to have to dump out my bag under the watchful eye of some kind of lawman. Now, that could have been written as fact today. It didn't even need to be in a work of fiction, right? I mean, I'm sure many African Americans feel that way. I'm just wondering, I mean, this brings us right to a question which I know you've grappled with and a lot of people have asked you. You're white. Why did you decide to write in the voice of a black man in the book?
Well, for this book, there could be no other point of view character. It is a book very much about the history of anti-black racism in this country. And as you point out, Magna, in that passage, that could very easily be written in a non-alternate history. I've started to think of this book as an alternate history that isn't alternate enough. So, yeah, I'm white. I am white, and I wrote this book because I think it is incumbent upon white people, white authors very much included, to think about racism, to grapple with racism, and to engage with it.
I take your point. And I mean, obviously, the story of slavery is one of the defining stories of America, and it is a story of black Americans and white Americans. But
that's right.
I'm curious about how you confronted the challenge or question of, could you write in an authentic voice, not being black yourself?
I confronted it in the way that I think it is beholden upon any white person who is writing a character who is not white with extraordinary care and knowledge. I tried to steep myself in as much knowledge as I could steep myself in. One of the first things I read was this long article by Ta-Nehisi Coates in The Atlantic about reparations. I read Ralph Ellison and Toni Morrison and Octavia Butler. I mean, I tried to read as much African-American literature as I could, stories that in various ways expressed the black experience in America. And also just by talking to people, by knowing people, and by living in the world. And when I got to a certain point working on the book, I had to just say, well, this is my main character. This is my guy. And I'm not going to try to create some quote unquote black voice or black way of thinking, because all you have to do is talk to more than one black person. You realize there is no such thing as a universal way that black people are and black people think, which isn't to say that black Americans aren't shaped by the BS that they put up with and the indignities and the inequalities and the fear of violence that they deal with every day. But it was important to me to write this book. I feel that the book has, fallen down a rabbit hole here.
Well, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I think we'd all be better off if every American, regardless of race, engaged as deeply as they could with the history of racism and its effect on our present as a nation. So I don't mean to put you, on the defensive here. I'm very, very, I'm in awe of the book. But obviously, I mean, it's a question that you've been asked a lot.
And you can tell it's not an easy question to answer. And I think it's important to acknowledge that there's sort of another level of issues here, which has to do with the fact that the attention that my book has gotten and sort of the framing of the book as being somehow pathbreaking or daring or whatever, when there are so many authors of color who have written about racism and even in sort of speculative or science fiction contexts and not received the attention. And so that enters into it, because I have to acknowledge that although my book, I feel, is valuable and it's about, in many ways, it's about white privilege, the book itself, in a weird way, becomes an example of that.
Well, I wonder what the process of researching, thinking about, talking to other people and writing this book, did that transform your understanding or how you view slavery and its effect on America today?
Yes. I mean, I think like a lot of white people, I think that I grew up with the idea that the most important thing was not to be racist, to see everybody as equal. And I think that is obviously so. But I think that unlike many black people, I never had to deal with the sort of day-to-day racism that comes from not from just individuals being mean or being racist, but from institutions. And so once I began, my awareness of these things heightened and heightened and heightened and heightened as I was working on the book.
Hmm. Now, Ben, a lot of readers know you for your The Last Policeman trilogy, and I'm just wondering, with Underground Airlines, I got a sense that maybe there's the possibility of a sequel. Is it too soon to ask if you want to continue the story?
Yeah, well, I don't think so. Having spent several years writing a trilogy of novels all about how we behave under the specter of impending death, and then having spent the next couple of years writing a novel about how we behave under the shadow of slavery and racism. Racism is so much worse than death, you know, because death is inevitable and it is organic and there's nothing we can do about it. We just have to deal with it. Racism is something that, like, we tolerate and we are the beneficiaries of it sometimes without even thinking about it. And that is a much scarier thing.
Hmm. Well, Ben Winter's new book is Underground Airlines. Ben, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
An honor. Thank you very much.
It's Here and Now at the DNC in Philly. Last night saw the most serious protests of either convention so far. More than 24 people were arrested here, compared to about 18 in Cleveland. Important to those arrested, but in the scope of things, well, demonstrations have not been anything like what was anticipated, and certainly nothing like the anti-war protests at the DNC in Chicago in 1968. Just ask this guy, Tom Hayden, was one of the protest organizers in 68, and at 76, this Michigan native is recovering from a stroke, but still an activist, and he joins us on Radio Row. Welcome.
Hi, nice to be on this strange row.
I know. Well, I got to paint the picture. You're
it's better than death row.
Yes, there are other rows that are worse.
What can I do for you?
First, I want to tell people, you got your Made in Detroit hat on, you got your Hillary button on. Some people would have thought, you know, the progressive Tom Hayden, the activist, the agitator, it would have been Bernie. Was it Bernie at one time?
Bernie and I only have one thing in common that you need to know. We're both politicians, so we make decisions based on what's possible. And my decision was that she was going to get all the African-American and Latino votes and then the women's votes and organized labor, more or less. So why would I turn my back on my friends of a lifetime? You know, I've really been trying to work towards a goal that seems to be getting realized, and that's a serious united front against Trump. And I must say, I'm not one of the people that has a pathological issue about Hillary Clinton. I like Hillary Clinton.
Hold up a second, Tom Hayden. She voted for the war in Iraq. Now, she says she's sorry now, but people on Bernie Sanders' side are saying, why didn't you read the intelligence that showed there was no weapons of destruction? Well, you might have been the protester standing out there with a sign.
She said like 1,000 times she made a mistake, so let's pass on that, for God's sakes.
Okay, well, what is it, do you think, that not just the Democrats, but the Republicans are missing about Donald Trump? I mean, he's appealing to something that the Republican candidates weren't able to appeal to, and the Democrats haven't been able to appeal to. Why do you think it is that he's doing so well? What is the upset?
I think there's three factors. One, 25 years in the public eye as a television actor. Two, economic nationalism.
He's appealing to people who believe that some jobs are going to come back, and they probably aren't, according to
economists. They're not coming back.
Yeah.
So the TPP fight is not over. It's causing a big problem for the Clinton base in Michigan and in the Rust Belt. You've got to repair that. But there has to be a way to consolidate and strengthen her opposition to the TPP.
But on the other hand, other people, including economists, have said, no, don't tear this up. We've got to have this kind of trade. It's a global economy.
Oh, no, we're past that.
You are? Because they've said, we've got to retrain people in the Rust Belt so that they can do some of the jobs that there are, engineering jobs.
That's been a...
You don't buy that?
The fact is, we've lost these hundreds of thousands of jobs as a direct result of these free trade agreements. The backup position was always that, well, we'll retrain the losers. And that has proved to be politically problematic for the Democratic Party and a total disaster to hundreds of thousands of people in the world I come from.
Yeah.
The whole process is completely secret, and that's been a pretty hot issue with the CIA and with drones and many issues. But secret money, campaign finance, But I would recommend that people take up transparency as a rejection of secrecy. Mm-hmm. That's a starting point.
Just know what the deals behind closed doors are. Tom Hayden.
No, give a voice in those deals. Pass the infrastructure bill, putting hundreds of thousands of people to work, which I think Bernie and Hillary both agree on.
A big piece in the New York Times recently, the rallying cry for Democrats could be infrastructure. You know, let's just repair things, and there is your jobs program. Tom Hayden.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. We had an interesting conversation with a much younger colleague, and he was asking about the 60s, and some colleagues were filling in of what it was like, and people were worried here about what might happen at some of the protests. This young person said to me, wow, because we were explaining how much violence there was and is in Chicago, and he said, wow, my friends and I, we thought we were in a movement, but now I'm not sure we are in a movement. Because he's realizing that in the 60s, you really could see it. You could see it on your TV screens. What would you say to that? I mean, does there have to be smoke bombs and police batons for it to be, or is it more happening on social media?
Wait, those are mounted machine guns, not smoke bombs.
I'm talking about 68.
I know.
Yeah.
Mounted machine guns.
Right.
In our face. This week you've had some disorder, but what you've noticed is that the will to demonstrate and speak truth to power with illegal civil disobedience has dissipated because people know that plays into Trump's hands. One other thing that very few people in progressive circles talk about is the inevitable rise of a really very moving and inspirational feminism in the person of the first female president.
That's Tom Hayden, activist, still agitating. Thank you so much. Pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
Great. Thanks very much.
That's what I love about conventions, Meghna. You just never know who you're going to find. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.